Don't Blink, Season 9, Episode 4, Before the Flood.
Hello, sweetie. Welcome to Don't Blink, a fan podcast dedicated to Doctor Who. Grab your bow ties, 3D glasses, and sonic screwdriver, and come along for some timey-wimey adventures across the Doctor Who universe. And now, here are your hosts, David and Jeremy.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Jeremy.
And I'm David.
And we're here to discuss Doctor Who. This week we're discussing Before the Flood, the episode of the fourth episode of the ninth season of Doctor Who. And I loved this episode. It was fun. Last week I gave the, I guess the prequel, you could call it, a rating of 7. But this week I liked it a lot more. David, tell me about your host rating this week.
Yeah, I'm going to hold true with this and give it 9 dragging axes, because I really, really like this. It had a few faults, but the whole was far better than the sum of the parts. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually gave it 9 as well this week. I gave it 9 giant bootstrapped leaps. So we have, I'm kind of throwing everything together there. But yeah, it was definitely a fun episode. We learned a lot. They kind of answered and completed last week's episode. And I said last week that it just needed to resolve itself, really, to become a great episode for me. And I think they did a wonderful job with this episode.
Yeah, it sort of felt to me, I felt that the opening two episodes in the series didn't feel very Moffat-y. He does these really big set pieces that are sort of very catchy visually and from a plot perspective. And he didn't really do that so much with the Dalek ones. But with this one, I felt like this was part two of the series. Like, it just came in with a freshness and some really clever stuff right off the start, out of the gate. So I really, really adored this. And we're doing well. Like, basically 4 for 4, I think, this series.
Yeah, it's been a great season so far. I know last season, the fourth episode was Listen, which I think I may have given a 10 because it's probably among my favorites ever. It was a brilliant episode, but the other episodes seemed to kind of almost be drugged down early last season. This one was just, it was strong. It completed a good story arc, and 4 for 4, I would definitely say.
Yeah, Listen was good, but for me, that was by far the highest spike of last year.
Yeah.
That was a tall poppy, whereas this, it's like consistently really, really great, and that's, I think, part of it is Capaldi and part of it is the direction, but we can talk about that.
Yeah, well, speaking of direction, our writer and director this week were Stephen Moffat, Toby Whitehouse, the same people we had last week. But our actor this week is Peter Serafinowicz.
Yeah, there's some really, really unusual voice talent in this episode. When I heard the voice of the Fisher King, and I keep wanting to, for some reason, I keep wanting to call that character the Widowmaker. I don't know why, genuinely. I thought it was Michael Sheen, who is an impressionist, and he did the voice. Yeah, you know the guy who did the voice of House in The Doctor's Wife? That's got a very kind of silky sort of thing. So I was really surprised to hear that that wasn't him, but it was a really, really cool voice.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people will know him as an actor as Pete in Shaun of the Dead, but a lot more people might know him or recognize at least the role he voice acted for as Darth Maul from Star Wars Episode 1. But how many lines do you think Maul had in that movie, David?
God, I should say about the same amount as Boba Fett. Probably like 5?
Probably.
Maybe 5 to 9, I would, yeah.
I actually looked it up, and I don't know if IMDb is correct, but according to IMDb, in the actual movie, he had 2. One was, Tatooine is sparsely populated. If the homing trace is correct, I will find them quickly, Master. And the second was, at least we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last, we will have revenge. That's all he said. So I think it's interesting. He has credit for being the voice of Darth Maul, but not a whole lot of speaking that I can tell.
And you know, he gets asked at conventions to do those 2 lines.
Yeah.
Again and again.
I don't know if I'd ask anybody from a Star Wars prequel to do a line from the prequel. So.
Yeah, right. Best keep that to themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other really cool thing about this was Corey Taylor, who you may know from Slipknot.
Yes.
it's just such a great idea that they get the dude from Slipknot to come in and voice the roar of a monster. I don't know. So can I be, I'm going to be a little bit insensitive here, Jeremy, culturally speaking. How close is Iowa to Oklahoma? like geographically.
Wow, just really?
As a limey, I have no idea. How?
Okay, all right.
Where are they, like, spatially? Are they close together? Is like, Iowa anywhere near you, or?
We're not a border state, no, but yeah, we are pretty close, I mean, relatively. Iowa State is in the Big 12 of college NCAA sports, and so is Oklahoma, so.
Okay, so this is your homeboy, then.
I guess you could call him a homeboy. We are separated essentially by Kansas and Nebraska, or Missouri, pick one, but. I don't know. It's northeast.
I'm not a Slipknot fan by any means, although that record Iowa, there was one really killer song on it, which really surprised me that I liked a Slipknot song. It just got me. They got the dude in to do the Roar of the Monsters, which I want to see more of. Like, you know, that's the kind of stuff I think a high profile show like Doctor Who can pick up. It's fun, but
yeah. Well, speaking of Star Wars, they probably should have gotten him for the voice of the Darth Vader. No, but I don't know. The infamous no.
And then another kind of curio as casting was the fellow that played Prentice.
Yes.
He is a sort of comic actor that you see in Britain sometimes. He used to play a kind of pranking type character called Dennis Penis, who was very much like Ali G, and that he would gate crash red carpet interviews, and like, remember there was a great moment where he went up to OJ Simpson on a red carpet and asked for his autograph.
Really?
And when he got it, he unfolded it and the top of the piece of paper said, "I did it."
Awesome. Okay.
And I saw the Prodigy play Glastonbury, and they all came on stage like really full of, like, you know, vinegar and, oh yeah, we're gonna do this, and there was a power cut leaving only the microphones. Hmm. And because they're an entirely electronic band, they were completely stuck. So they had to get this guy out and kind of fill in the meantime. And so he was just completely terrified and giving an impromptu stand-up show to however many people at Glastonbury, 60,000 people. And it's so funny that his character in this is sort of the most timid, like, mousy, mole-like personality when the guy is a real provocateur in real life. I have no idea how they cast him.
Yeah, I think he made an interesting looking character, and we'll kind of get into to his character in a bit, and a little bit more about Tivolians. But yeah, he was really timid, and I thought that was brilliant. But I kind of dig what they made the Tivolians become. But before we get into him, let's actually break the fourth wall and get into the introduction here. What did you think about this introduction to Doctor Who?
I loved it. I thought that. It, maybe with a different director or a different actor, it could have been horrible, but Capaldi played it note perfect. I just really, really liked it. And I also felt that, because we'd seen Capaldi talking to himself in Listen.
Right.
It had sort of, like, it sort of eased us into this idea of the Doctor kind of giving you a monologue. I don't know. It worked for me. What about you? How did you enjoy that, Jeremy?
I don't know. This was actually probably my least favorite part of the entire episode. And not because of what he said, because what he said, I'll get into here in a moment. But the breaking the fourth wall, I think, is actually what they call it, where the actor speaks directly to the audience in that kind of style, was really weird. And it just kind of rubbed me kind of funny. But at the same time, yeah, we've seen him do several different kind of monologues to himself. He'll talk to himself. That might even be called a soliloquy. I'm not really up on my theater right now, but it's one of those things where they talk by themselves. That's all I know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It was weird.
I feel like a soliloquy would be when you don't know that someone's listening, and a monologue would be when maybe you do have an audience. I'm not sure. Okay. In the classic series, there was, because you couldn't do a retake. There was no time. Unless something really bad, especially in the early days, the black and white, unless something really bad happened, you just had to, like, muscle through it.
Really?
And so if you were really an actor and you were really uncomfortable with your performance, you'd curse, because that's the one thing they couldn't. But there was a Christmas episode with William Hartnell, and it was a really great long serial that there was a Christmas episode in the middle of it, and he just completely improvised and broke character and picked up a glass of wine and said Merry Christmas to everyone watching at home.
All right, so we have seen this before.
We have seen this before, right. Yeah.
Just a long, long time ago.
There's precedent. So, right. But he picks up the guitar, which I'm a guitar player, so I approve.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of hacking away at Beethoven.
Yeah.
Or he's a guitar player. He could have learned as a solo rather than power chords, but you know, everyone's a critic.
Yeah, I kind of liked what he did there. And we've seen him already use a guitar once this season. That's in the tank at the premiere this season. So he's already kind of demonstrated that. But he mentions one of the other things that bothered me about the introduction was Google it. And he's talking about the bootstrap paradox. And to me, that was product placement. And I really hate it when it gets in front of my sci-fi. But in fact, I think that would probably be the sole reason I had a problem with the introduction, was the product placement, if you will. But besides that, the entire intro was interesting, and he mentions the bootstrap paradox, which is also known as the causal loop, which we've seen before in Doctor Who in an episode that some like to refer to as Blink.
So yeah, it's a classic sort of time travel trope. It's interesting that they've not done that in Doctor Who really in any significant way before the new series. But this one is a lot like Blink is a nicer kind of like smooth paradox where things for the most part work out, but this is nastier. Right. This is edgier. Yeah. This isn't wibbly wobbly. This is sharp and it's like a trap. It catches you.
Yeah. More jagged edges here.
Much more jagged. So honestly, I'm trying to articulate why the intro didn't annoy me, and I can't justify it. I've got nothing. I should agree with you entirely. It just kind of worked for me. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go back to the paradox, but we got to mention that rock version of the theme music.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
My wife actually said that was awesome. So she liked it. So I guess I have to like it, right?
Yeah. You know, it's like finding a stray cat. You know, you're not going to get to keep it, but you really want to keep it.
There you go. All right. Yeah. So that's the paradox that we have in Doctor Who. Rock intros, but
intros. What are you going to do? Yeah. Well, it's funny because for a time travel show, Doctor Who doesn't use the concept of time very often, and this gives you a real feeling of doom. You just get a sense that this is going to be a little bit different. So, and that sets up. When the TARDIS lands back in the 80s, it sets up that very desolate kind of railway station type set beautifully. And you just know this is leveled up, right, or leveled down. This is going to get interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to cause what to happen and what's going on. And we have that at the beginning with the Beethoven conversation, and we're here in 1980. And then I think this is at a location. Forgive me, I cannot remember the name of the location that they're in where the dam breaks, but it looks to be like a British training facility, much like we've seen in the past, that we know about from in the past, where the Russians would have copies of American civilizations or Western kind of, I say civilizations, towns, things like that, and how to infiltrate them. Well, we kind of see the inverse of that here with what looks like a British version of a Russian town.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a sort of, it's an interesting trope. It reminds me of The Prisoner a little bit, which is a great 1960s TV show. I used to work selling houses in a housing estate that was modeled around a traditional English village, but it was completely phony. It was built from the ground up, and it was completely empty and desolate and on top of a hill. And I was there on Saturdays, and I'd often have to go up into like the third floor and there's no power. It was scary as all hell. And it was the kind of place that you would train like foreign spies to acclimatize to. So it's an interesting concept, and I'm not quite sure why they did it, but I like that they did it.
Yeah, it was kind of fun, and we get the three of them, the Doctor, O'Donnell, and Bennett, kind of appearing in the TARDIS here. And I love O'Donnell. I think from a quick Google search, a lot of people liked her, and I agree with a lot of other sentiments that I would have loved to have seen her as the next companion, because she was great. I dug her a lot. She had the wonderful accent that I really dig from Amy, very similar to Amy Pond or Karen Gillan, at least to me as my American ears. But she had a wonderful, just, I don't know, a love for the Doctor, the whole "it's bigger on the inside" comment, and then her knowledge. And she mentioned quite a few things at the beginning here that we're going to have to get into real quick. One of them being the moon exploding. So she mentions that the moon explodes, or this is before the exploding moon, or the moon exploded. I can't remember exactly how she said it, but it to me is a reference to Kill the Moon, which is sad because that means that it's probably the final nail in my hope that none of that ever happened.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, and she mentions Harold Saxon too, which yes. A was one of my favorite Doctor Who episodes ever, the Harold Saxon like trilogy.
Yeah.
And it's gotten mentioned several times, and I really like that thing was seen to have consequences in the real world. Like Saxon is constantly name checked.
Yeah.
It's mentioned in Torchwood after the fact. It's mentioned by Osgood, mm-hmm. When she's talking about, you know, not even the worst prime minister we ever had, she says, yeah. Which is great. But I agree with you. O'Donnell was a fantastic character. And what happened, because last week they were all like completely cardboard.
Yeah.
And suddenly
they livened up like at the very beginning of this episode.
Yeah, suddenly they realize, okay, they suddenly become fleshed out real people. Like, it's incredible. It's like, just add water, you know, just add boiling water. Suddenly I really care about them. Or a flood, exactly, yeah. So it was just like the whole, you know, what, something's in my shoe, you know, then she, you know, she's all excited and it's bigger on the inside. It's like, mm-hmm. it's not what you expect her to do. And yeah, she looks very much like a future companion. So
yeah,
loved it.
Yeah, and I knew the whole time she was going to die because of what she said last week, and there was a lot more that she said this week, but I found it terribly interesting that she mentions Harold Saxon, but especially with the lack of her mention of Missy as the master or anything like that. And then she also mentions the Minister of War, which kind of implies we're going to see this Minister of War in a future episode, I'm hoping. I mean, we have a lot of things that from a certain diary that we're looking forward to in the future too. But wasn't Harold with the Ministry of Defense?
He was. He got into government via the Ministry of Defense. Yeah,
right.
I would like it either way. It's great if they've set this up as a future, you know, villain, or maybe even mm-hmm. a villain this year. I also quite like the idea. It's one of those Doctor Who things that's never ever mentioned again. You know, and some
I hate that.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah.
But you know that like some novelist in like 2000 oh, yeah. and 40 is going to write the you know, that novel.
Yes,
you know, it's like, I find that stuff to be kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of hypothesizing here. I'm kind of reaching. Yes, I know. And I'll reach again later in this episode of Don't Blink. But is the Minister of War Missy with Daleks?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good question, because the whole at the end of her last episode where she says, I've got an idea,
yes.
you know it's an alliance of some kind,
yeah.
So.
So, I don't know, we're just kind of poking the snake there, if you will. So we got to get this fun introduction with O'Donnell and with Bennett throwing up the one giant leap, one great, I thought that was funny. I loved O'Donnell. The writing for O'Donnell was great. The acting for O'Donnell was great. I really, really, really wish we'd see her again. But moving on, she's dead. So let's go to, well, she's not dead yet. But
I don't know in Stephen Moffat if that means much,
that's
to be honest.
That's true.
So.
But we get to see Prentice. And we've already kind of spoken about him briefly as an actor. But we get Prentice this week, and he's our ghost from last week, the initial ghost, if you will, and the Undertaker, I think, would be a good name for him. But he's a Tivolian, if I'm not pronouncing that. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But I think we saw that in Torchwood. We've seen that before in, there was an episode. Was it the one in the hotel? He's kind of a coward.
Yeah, that's where we've seen them. It was the God Complex, the hotel one. One of those many Doctor Who's that from that era that I've only seen once, so I can't remember a huge amount about it. But yeah, someone likes those monsters. It was written by Toby Whitehouse, so I assume that it was his callback to his own. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He's kind of bringing that back to what he's done before with the Tivolians, and I definitely enjoyed what we see with them. They remind me of Minions from, I mean, you can say the movie Minions or Despicable Me. They're these people who crave an overlord, you know, they want to be conquered. And I thought that was definitely a fun, sadistic sort of thing to watch. I thought it was funny, but at the same time, yeah, it's a little awkward.
Yeah. Well, now I don't like to think that I've got a Dirty Mind. And I know this is a family show, but there is a line in this episode where he says something to the effect of, we have devices that you can use to, or something. Do you know what I mean? I was like, oh, geez, let's back away from that.
Yeah.
Is that what that is? I don't know. Are we all not saying that?
I'm not sure, but
good.
I don't know. But he did have a business card, and I thought, as the seventh movie for the Star Wars series will be coming up, the business card was, May the Remorse Be With You, and I thought that was kind of a funny little shout-out.
Is that what it said?
Apparently.
I didn't catch that. I love that.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's this interesting little undertaker. He was actually wonderful. I loved him. I was kind of hoping they'd find a way to save him, but at the same time, I mean, there's more Tivolians where he came from, I'm sure, so... But he takes us to the ship that we see from last week. It's actually a hearse, which I thought was pretty funny. It really went with his character, with the whole shtick that he's kind of presenting. So.
Yeah, that was a great piece of design. Like it is a hearse, but it isn't. But it is, which I thought was very, very smooth.
Well, it's funny. Once he said it was a hearse, that's all I could see from that spaceship from there on out. When I watched, I actually rewatched last week's episode, and that's all I could see the entire time.
But it goes back to what we were saying last week about putting an unconscious idea in someone's mind.
Right, exactly.
We probably both had that in our unconscious or subconscious, and we never knew it.
Yeah, if somebody had given us that word, we'd be like, sure, that makes total sense.
Exactly. Gotta love it.
Yeah. So we get this introduction to the ship, and we see this mummy, if you will, kind of hanging out, supposedly dead. But we'll find more about him later, because we're actually going to go back to the future, and we're going to see Clara and her crew, a.k.a. Cass and Lun, hanging out, watching the ghost of the Doctor.
Who's just there, which is sort of hugely uncomfortable. And it is massively uncanny seeing it's the Doctor with those eyes. You know, and Clara really does look... Like it's almost sadistic how she's got to be sat there with this thing, this kind of thing hovering in the water, which is, again, we had a huge discussion last week in a show that we didn't correctly record about Deep Blue Sea, but it really reminded me of Deep Blue Sea again. And so it was a very strong image, and I'm really curious to know how kids reacted like now to this episode and how they're going to remember it in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Because it was pretty strong stuff. Like, those eyes are kind of weird.
I liked them. I dug them. And I think during one of the commercial breaks, they actually showed kind of the makeup or the mask that they were using. I thought that was kind of neat, too. But the Doctor hanging out, floating in the deep blue sea, he's reciting names. They kind of, they see these words and... they're just, it's a random pattern of names. I thought that was kind of interesting. He was saying something different. We didn't know why he was saying something different at this point in the episode. But we had plenty of time to speculate on that. And the next one was going to be O'Donnell, which just breaks my heart. And I knew that was probably going to be her death, but I couldn't confirm it. But yeah, we have kind of that. I think the Doctor calls Clara here too. Was it him calling her, or did she call him?
He calls her.
Okay.
On her phone by some kind of major phone retailer. I'm not sure exactly what.
Yes, this is the second product placement of the episode, and that was the reason I deducted a whole point. So the product placement just, it bothers me. I don't mind it when it's not obvious, but when they're doing their damnedest, if you will, to display it, it just kind of bothers me. I don't know.
Well, it's not the worst product placement I've ever seen, which I think I would probably give that to maybe to Skyfall.
Okay.
Which just has some extraordinarily gratuitous shots of his watch, actually.
You have a very good point. Yes, yes.
I mean, it had to be a phone. So, and in fairness, my phone is by no means that brand. I use a different operating system.
Yes, which I
but it looks identical. So it was actually, I had a very different reaction, because I was looking at that and thinking, this is my phone. And just for this moment in time, what's on the screen is in my pocket. And I know that in 2 years' time that will be antiquated and it won't work. But I found a real moment of connection with that, and it didn't annoy me particularly. But I don't know.
All right. Well, hey, I mean that's definitely a good way to look at it, and maybe I should just shut up about my product placement here. But yeah, because I definitely like it when they say Coca-Cola versus Coke. Or something when they just invent a name. I hate that. So yeah, product placement isn't so bad, but who knows? Yeah, you can identify more. But we have kind of Clara speaking to the doctor here, and at one point she just kind of reveals to him, "You're the ghost we see out the window, and what do you want us to do about it?"
Yeah, and I think she thinks she's going to get more of a positive outcome from it. And he's like, I guess he's like, oh, well, less that then.
Yeah. I have to die now. She's like, what? So I don't know. I didn't really buy this. I believe a lot of people are probably going to hypothesize that this was a big moral struggle for the doctor and how he can change time and all these points in life where he's not supposed to touch them. But I didn't catch that at all. I'm thinking, yeah, you're not going to kill yourself because you're not giving away your little confession dial. Well, it must not be a confession dial. I don't know. It's probably a TARDIS. But hey, there's a lot running through my mind in this part that I just shared with our listeners that I really just had a hard time just believing that he was willing to die.
I kind of took this scene on face value, actually. I sort of thought that there was a nice resignation about it. And I love the line where he sort of said, "Well, this regeneration is a clerical error," which I really, really enjoyed for some reason. And it's one of those things, if you try to explain it to someone that didn't instinctively know what he's talking about, it would take all day and wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But you just sort of know, you know, he's out of regenerations, and who knows which one he's on anyway, because
we lost count.
Yeah. We lost count, yeah.
Tenet counts for two. But yeah, I don't know. It was interesting. I thought, you know, the doctor thinks he can always win. We've seen that already this season. He's not going to die. There's no way he's going to succumb to this. So how is he going to fake it? The idea of a hologram didn't really pass through my mind. I don't know why we saw it last week. But despite that, I mean, we get this fun scene between the doctor and Ghost Doctor. Nothing happens with Ghost Doctor. He kind of ignores the regular doctor, and he releases the other ghosts from the Faraday cage, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and then you have the scene when O'Donnell refuses to stay behind and babysit the TARDIS. And the first time I watched that, I kind of saw where it was going. But watching it the second time, one of the criticisms online is that the Doctor didn't really try very hard to save her.
Right.
He's culpable for her death. And watching it the second time, I thought, no, that's not true. Like, he really did give it as good a punt as you can expect.
Yeah, but he also knew that she was going to die. And Bennett is angry because she dies for letting her die. Because Bennett even believes that the doctor didn't try hard enough. So, yeah, I mean, I can see the anger online as well as the anger from Bennett at this point. And it was very, very similar to Clara's reaction last season.
Now I'm about to knot myself up so horribly.
Well, congratulations,
you. Yeah. Oh my goodness, I don't. This I had such a hard time following the causality of this, but which happens first? But if the doctor had seen it all happen before and then gave that effort to stop O'Donnell leaving the TARDIS, I would agree with you that he didn't try very hard. But given he's not seen it, it actually seems like a reasonable effort. Like, he really does give it a shot, you know?
Okay.
Because he doesn't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen.
Yeah, because the fact that Clara was the second name, and he even says as much later that she's the second name, is the reason that he knew he had to kind of save her. If she had been the first name, it wouldn't have struck any chords. She would have died. So the fact that he set her as number two was that reason. And the doctor from the future, or the doctor in the causality loop, that doesn't actually exist because Beethoven didn't actually write the fifth. The doctor wrote the fifth or provided the fifth, all of that jazz. Since that list came from nowhere, essentially, in this loop, the doctor is kind of responsible for it. But, yeah, I mean, what you have to say is definitely an interesting point.
Okay, so now we leave the TARDIS and we're going back out to investigate what's actually happening out in the village, and we get this real sense that things are—it's an avalanche. We see the Undertaker has been killed. We see the words are on the side of the hearse, and then we move into the monster section of the episode, which to me was absolutely. How do they put this stuff out for kids? It amazes me. I love it, but I thought, wow, yeah. It gets scary pretty quickly.
Yeah, the Fisher King, the costume they made for him was brilliant. I loved it. I thought he looked great, kind of creepy, kind of reminded me of Starship Troopers for a moment, but at the same time, it definitely reminded me of just an awesome alien. It was creepy. I really kind of dug that. And we had the Halloween sort of episode last week. This week, it didn't give us that same type of feel, but at the same time, it gave us a great monster. So,
yeah, for some reason, the juxtaposition of the monster and the sort of 1980s bare brick barracks, it just worked for me. I can't explain why it clicked so well. There were so many beautiful design details. When they locked themselves in the room, the doctor locked himself in, and the look when the chair gets put under the door handle. Did you catch that? He looks at it like, yeah. All right, sure, let's try that then. But behind them, there's like a shooting range target in red. There's two of them.
Right on the wall.
Yeah, on the wall. And for some reason, it's just a nice little piece of like unconscious symbolism, you know?
Yeah, I didn't pick up the target, but I definitely did pick up the propaganda, the red. It kind of made them a target, but I didn't pick up on the shooting target. So.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it is, or at least that was what it registered with me, and that gives you that unconscious sense of danger. And then O'Donnell, when she gets attacked, that's pretty intense. The noise she makes when she's on the ground is my heart went out. I felt... Yeah. My goodness, I suppose that makes you empathize with the grief in the situation, but I don't know, it was pretty heavy.
Yeah, I was really sad to see her go. I was really hoping I was wrong last week. I thought, you know, maybe she could survive, but yeah, we offer here and she had one of those sad moments in Doctor Who where somebody that I think a lot of fans are really identifying with as fans of the Doctor, you know? So we see this everyman O'Donnell essentially die. And it's very sad, but we get this good reaction from Bennett where he kind of similar, like we said earlier, to Clara's reaction. And then the Doctor tells Bennett that he's his goal is to save Clara, not himself, because he's kind of supposedly resigned to dying at this point, and he wants to save Clara. And another reach for Jeremy, but I'm thinking, is this a foreshadowing of Clara's ultimate demise and death later this season, that the Doctor is willing to do whatever it takes to save her?
Yeah, it feels more and more like that. I've got to agree. But he has that Time Lord victorious moment where they go into the TARDIS. He says, oh, who's going to stop me? And, you know, and that's Waters of Mars, basically.
Yeah.
And the TARDIS won't let him.
Yes.
His wife is not going to let him do something stupid, right. Which I think you and I can both probably relate to.
Yeah, totally identify with that. But yeah, the TARDIS won't let him go back to the future. And he's stuck in his own time stream. Which I thought was kind of it was very Doctor Who-ish here in this scene where he's stuck. He kind of pokes his head out. He sees himself leaving the other TARDIS, and it was just like, that's a good moment for time travel. It's just fun. And I didn't mention earlier, but this whole bootstrap paradox is probably my favorite paradox in all of time travel. I love it. So seeing him kind of stuck in this moment, we don't know what's going to happen, but we know something's happening with this, with the ultimate end. It was just very fun to see how he influenced the outcome. But
yeah,
I like that moment.
I liked it a lot, and it's really I found it really scary and sinister that they've tried, because he always, you know, you always hear them say, well, if there'll be this paradox if we travel back in time and save X or Y, or if we try and they've never really done it. The Doctor's never done it deliberately where he said, okay, well, let's go back in time and change something. And he's barely started at this point. And you already see, this is not good. He's been thrown back half an hour and he's already it really brings home why you don't do this.
Yeah. And it just kind of, it gives you that doom, that dread that you have over what happens if they run into each other. And we've seen them before with Rose, kind of how she goes back in time and meets her dad and how it screws everything up. And we see in this episode the attempt that I got a great kick out of, the doctor tackling Bennett to prevent him from saving the one he loved, a.k.a. O'Donnell.
Yeah, I was completely on the hook at this point emotionally. Like, I was in Bennett's sort of shoes, I think, thinking, you'd do that, wouldn't you? I mean, and it's a fun little like tackle that the doctor does. He really knocks him over. But by this point, you've started to see the events of the past play out. So now they're really rubbing your face in them too, because you're seeing O'Donnell, and it's and now the doctor's got the rip in the jacket, and you think, oh, that's not going to be good,
right?
You know. Once that sort of like that symbol occurs, in any time travel thing, okay, we're in trouble now.
Yeah, something bad is about to happen. And they take us from that tackle, from that moment with the ripped coat, back again to Clara and Cass and Lun. And they're in the Faraday cage with the phone outside, as the doctor had told Clara to do, so she could see it was him, it's safe, let's go pick up the phone, and we're good. But we see the ghost of O'Donnell, which I find interesting. It hasn't been here, in the past, in the previous scenes that we see in this episode, because she's just dead now, but she's been dead for 140 years. I don't know, it's kind of weird. Don't let me confuse you. But O'Donnell, knowing that they're going to try and use the phone, at least that's my understanding, takes the phone.
I completely agree. That was the one plot hole that, I'm going to give it to them, because there's so much like pretzeling of time and everything. Right. I'm sure
It's timey-wimey. That's all we need to know.
It's quite funny because Stephen Moffat does seem, he often, let's be honest, my apologies if you're listening, Mr. Moffat, but he can be a little bit sloppy with loose ends. Like, I feel like he sometimes gets bored with his own stories and just is doing the next thing.
Right, but the first time you've said that to me.
Right, but he also does a great column in Doctor Who magazine, and people ask him these kinds of questions, and he normally has a very smart answer, which he's clearly just thought of.
Nice.
So I can see this becoming a question in Doctor Who magazine, and I'm curious to see what Moffat will say about that. But
We meant her to take the phone because of that reason, sure.
Yeah, the real reason you didn't see her as a ghost before is...
Right.
Because if we had have done, you would... I don't know. Mm-hmm. But now we move to the Fisher King, or the Widowmaker, as I'm still thinking of him.
Yes, yes.
I'm not sure why he took the sarcophagus into the church, but let's just roll with that.
I'm pretty sure he took it into the church to give the doctor a way out.
This is a great scene, because the voice carries the character alone, and it's really scary, and it there is a menace to it. And then when you finally see the costume design, as you say, it does not let you down. It's great. It reminded me a lot of the original Alien, actually, from the Ridley Scott movie. It's just something about the silhouette that's just broken up and really unpleasant. And it's such a huge costume too.
Yeah, it was massive. I don't know how tall the guy was in it, but his eyes were probably around chest level, but it's definitely this elaborate, huge costume. It's definitely fun to watch. And like you said, the silhouette, even if it was all blank, you didn't see his face, it's very imposing. Had a lot of good sharp edges. It was definitely a fun kind of way to see it. But you have this awesome dialogue where you can't see him yet, where they're walking kind of through this room, and it looked like an unfinished basement or an unfinished construction area. And I thought that was very... It was very good. It felt good, the starkness of it. But it still disguised who the Fisher King ultimately became when you finally see him. And that was a fun way to kind of slowly reveal the answers that he gives us.
Yeah, again, I'm just going to nerd back at the costume. If you're listening to this the week that the show went out, you've probably seen the Hulkbuster costume that someone put together for New York Comic Con, which is a huge costume. It's really, really... This is just a fan that made it. It's incredible. And I sort of wanted to do that with the Fisher King. Like, guess some... I don't know how you do it. I'm sure it's like three people standing on one another's shoulders.
Yes.
Like kids in an overcoat trying to get... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, trying to get into an R-rated movie,
right?
But it just works. It's really, really good. And there's a shot in a moment when the creature comes out of a church, out of the church, of course. And there's some very James Bond type music playing for some reason, but it's a very sustained shot of the creature in daylight. And it's almost as if the BBC is saying, look, it actually, we can't afford to do this. It does work.
This is our budget now.
You're seeing it all on the next 10 minutes is your license fee for the next 3 months.
Right.
But it's clearly a practical costume other than some of the mandibles. Like it is a real, you know, it's not CGI, which you've got to love too. But also, I love that the doctor, when you watch it, is deliberate. He's acting like he's scared, but what he's actually doing is sticking close to that that sarcophagus, right? Because he needs to get in the damn thing. So it's a very clever piece of body language from Capaldi.
Yeah, he's definitely essentially telling the viewer, "I'm going to get in." And at one point, the Fisher King kind of pins him up to it, essentially, and. The doctor is kind of leaning over it, and I thought he might get in at that moment in the episode, but it drug out a bit longer than that, which was fine. But yeah, you definitely kind of see the doctor trying to stay close to it, trying to make an effort to make sure he gets in there when the dam breaks. And we do get a few answers before the dam breaks from the Fisher King. We kind of were told that his armada is going to come and conquer Earth, and that's the point of the ghost signals. But the doctor's changed those signals, and we learned that. And speaking of the doctor changing signals, he's also changed kind of his feelings for the dead. He seems very, like, how dare you take away their death from them in this episode? I thought that was kind of an interesting point that he makes.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. You're right. I mean, it's like, you know, what was the line in Into the Dalek about? He's the second layer from the top, if you want to pay your condolences. So he's the top layer, if you want to say a few words.
Yeah, so it just definitely kind of showed that point. And I misspelled damn in my notes. I just noticed that. Sorry. I diverge because the next point we're moving into is the dam bursting as it explodes. I thought this was fun to kind of see the power cell actually play a role in this episode as well. The one from last week, it was missing. We didn't know where it was. Well, the doctor used it, which implies that he used it to begin with. He never became a ghost to give himself the words. So what's going on? It's that fun causal loop. You just don't know.
You lost me. You lost me. My head just is starting to... it's like scanners. Bang. Well, I did really like that, again, so they set up the Chekhov's gun, or whatever you want to call it, with the, how is the missing power cell going to play into the narrative? But it works so beautifully because it's part of that, effect shot where the dam is blown up, and it just looked great. There were like 10 things I loved about that effect shot. I loved how normal the village looks. It looks like somewhere I would have grown up around, you know, with that kind of green grass and that's particular shade of green and that kind of sky and that flintiness about it. And then just the effect of the flood was really, really terrific. And then that incredible reaction from the Fisher King.
Yeah, where he just kind of spreads his arms out and just lets it hit him.
Yeah, it's like arrogance and it's defiance and it's anger. And then it just gets wiped out so hard by the water. Yeah. It's like, and it's very underplayed. It's just a moment that you could have missed very easily. But I thought it was absolutely terrific.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. And I thought it was kind of a powerful moment for his demise. I don't know if he's dead because we might see him again. I hope we see this Fisher King or at least his race or species again because they were definitely awesome to look at. But the flood coming through the dam was the final straw in every theory I had about the doctor being in the stasis chamber. At that point, if I didn't think it, I would have been thinking, oh, he's getting into the safe. He's getting into the stasis chamber. And he does, and he's ultimately rescued at the end of the episode. But yeah, that was definitely one of those contingency plans that he has. But speaking of contingency plans, how about Security Protocol 712?
Absolutely. But when did they film that? Because his hair is really short and he's wearing the original costume. So really? I'm wondering, yeah, if you look at it, it looks like he filmed that a year ago.
Okay.
Which I think is terrific for two reasons. First of all, it just works. And second of all, if I was the producer of Doctor Who, I would always be filming bits with the Doctor that I never used, just so if they ever did like...
Just,
You're right, so if they ever did like the 15 Doctors, in 2040, you'd have something to use. And I'm wondering if that's what Moffat did with Capaldi. I could be wrong. Maybe they did something with the effects and the hair, and I don't know. But he looked very, very different to me. So,
yeah, I wasn't actually paying attention to the way he looks, but now that you kind of mentioned it, he did have the longer outfit, I think, or something. So yeah, it was interesting to see this image or hologram, if you will, of the Doctor kind of show up there.
He's wearing the gear he wears when he first turns up in Deep Breath, like the shirt and the sweater and all of the rest of it. So,
interesting.
But it was a fun callback to, you know, all the times we've seen the emergency protocols, which
maybe he filmed it the first episode last season. So
we
get this again this protocol 712, and I think we first saw it in Blink. And we didn't really get an episode or a resolution in this episode that I can recall with the TARDIS coming back and saving them. So I'm actually hypothesizing that this protocol is the Bootstrap Paradox Protocol, and it takes them back to the point where the Bootstrap ends. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It could be. It could be. We just don't know yet.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. It was definitely kind of fun. The TARDIS takes Bennett away, and the Doctor supposedly gets flooded, and no, he's not. He's in the stasis chamber. That now, again, we're back with Clara and the rest of the crew. We're in the stasis chamber, we're in this point where the Doctor is waking up from the stasis chamber, and it was definitely kind of a fun, hey, I'm here to save the day moment. But I think a lot of us saw it coming.
Yeah, we did. I mean you, because you told me last week and it never occurred to me. What I liked about this was that, yes, it was one of those, like, I am the Doctor plays kind of, you know, hero moments, but it did that Russell T. Davis thing where it sort of didn't matter because the point of it was the emotional core, and that is Bennett mourning O'Donnell.
Yeah.
And seeing her through the window. And that's what the show's about. It's not about the Doctor getting out of a freezer and running around. You know, it's about Cass and Lun and that unrequited love. And if you've got that kind of emotional core to a program, you can get away with kind of cheesier, you know.
Yeah.
So what a turnaround from last week where they were just like a bunch of random people in green, in olive drabs, you know. I loved it.
Yeah, they really built the characters up, and you could kind of tell, you know, Bennett really cared about O'Donnell. And I think it was kind of a fun little sappy scene where Bennett tells Lun to tell Cass that Lun loves her. And I thought it was funny because you have her reaction of it's supposed to be kind of a feigned anger. And Lun's like, that's just what he told me to say. And then she kisses him. And yeah, it's this sappy bit. It kind of feels like a chick flick, but at the same time, it's fun. It's that love that brings everything together. And yeah, like you kind of mentioned, that connects everything.
Yeah. And for all of the plot contrivance of having a character that's hard of hearing in the one story where people need to read lips. We talked about this last week, but I did like some of the situational humor that we got out of having an interpreter, which was funny. And that was a great payoff to that. So, and bless it. I loved it. But it just made me feel really bad for Bennett, who's like washed up now in some bar somewhere, some undersea bar.
I was actually kind of wondering if Bennett would eventually travel with the Doctor and meet Clara and they would fall in love, because I'm still having a hard time making everything from last season make sense. And now that it looks like every one of my theories is totally gone, the moon is definitely something that happened. It's just, what's Clara going to do? What's Bennett going to do? And I don't know. There's a lot of frustration.
Bennett's going to drink himself to death.
Yes.
And he'll be showing people he'll be showing strangers at the bar pictures of O'Donnell, but he won't have an actual picture. It will be a cell phone picture of her ghost, her eyeless ghost.
This is the one I love.
And people will back away from him slowly.
Yeah, he's going to be the creepy dude. So I don't know. So we get kind of a wonderful episode. It resolves in love, and I think love really communicates a lot to the viewer. And we see that in our attachment, or in mine personally, with O'Donnell. So yeah, it was definitely a fun episode. It really completed last week's episode, and I really enjoyed it. It was fun, for sure. It was definitely worth the ride.
Yeah, I loved it too. And we talked about this last week, you know, that the first part you sort of couldn't quite judge without the second. And yeah. this went somewhere so sideways and great. I just, like, everything it played for, it did. So fantastic stuff. I absolutely adored it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of sideways, tell us about a shock of the earth.
A shock of the earth. So classic Doctor Who homework. This is a having said there aren't any bootstrap paradoxes in classic Doctor Who, this one comes pretty close. I'm not sure if this one is on Netflix streaming, but I urge everyone to watch it because it's such a cool episode. It's Peter Davison, and he's pretty new still, the fifth Doctor, and he meets the Cybermen. And they redesign the Cybermen, and they are absolutely badass. They're fantastic. It's a very tight, action-packed, four-part story, and it's the only time, give or take, in the classic series when a companion dies. And it's brilliant. So Earthshock, it's four parts. It's the Cybermen trying to take out the planet Earth, and it's just one of my favorite all-time Doctor Who's. And it does have a lovely, nasty little time paradox in the tale. So get your Amazon Prime. They'll ship it to you in a couple of days. Watch it. Tell us what you think. And the documentaries and everything on the DVD are great too. So I highly recommend this one. And we want to hear from our Don't Blink listeners about that program and about Before the Flood, not the Bob Dylan record, the Doctor Who episode, and what you think is going to happen this season of Doctor Who, what you think about Capaldi's performance, what you think is going to happen to Clara, everything we want to know.
Yeah, and you can submit those theories and feedback by calling us at 304-837-2278, or you can visit our website at goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. You can also reach us at Twitter, at Rogue Oracle, or at GSM Podcasts, and you can reach us at Facebook at facebook.com/goldenspiralmedia.
I'm David Ward on Gallifrey Base. You'll find me kind of kicking around the classic series forum, so do say hello. And I'm sorry I'm not on Twitter.
All right. Well, until next week, if you ever find a way to time travel, do stay away from your ancestors. You don't want to be your own grandfather.
And the Doctor in Utah and the majestic tale of a madman in a box are used with permission by Silver Screen Records. They're composed by Murray Gold and performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ben Foster, taken from the original Doctor Who soundtrack, Doctor Who Series 6, available on Silver Screen Records.